Greetings from Church of the Resurrection, and thank you for taking time to listen to this message. We hope you find this message meaningful and relevant. We invite you to join us in worship at any time. We are located just south of 135th Street between Roe and Nall Avenue in Leawood, Kansas. If you have any questions or comments, or you would like a DVD of this service, you may reach us by phone at 913-897-0120. Please ask for the Well Bookstore or visit our website at www.cor.org, where you will find a link for our catalog. And now, may you be blessed as you give attention to the reading of God's Word.
I would invite you now to be able to stand as you are able for the reading of our Scripture. Our Scriptures this morning speak to us about the challenge of living simply. The first one is taken from Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 10. The lover of money will not be satisfied with money, nor the lover of wealth with gain. This also is vanity. And then from 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. And then lastly, from Matthew chapter 16, verse 26, for what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? May God's blessing be added to the reading of this word. Please be seated.
Fabulous life. Fabulous life.
Troubled real estate market.
But the big retailers are already trying to get you to spend early and spend often.
That promises to have a chilling effect on the American pocketbook.
Would you please take from your bulletin your sermon notes and study guide? Your sermon notes are an outline of today's message, and I'd like to encourage you to follow along and write down the things you'd like to remember and reflect upon. There's some statistics I'll share with you. You might want to write those down. At the bottom of the page, you'll find questions for discussion, and I'd like to encourage you to have a mealtime discussion over brunch or lunch today over this with your friends or family. On the backside, you'll find our study guide readings, which are daily opportunities to read the Bible and meditate upon God's Word. And then beneath that, kind of your own personal study questions, questions to consider as you're thinking about today's message throughout the week. All right, today we begin a new series of sermons called Simplicity, Generosity, and Joy, in which we're thinking about our relationship to stuff and to the norms in our culture, and then trying to see what does the Bible call us to. And my goal for the series is that it's fun, it's hope-filled, and that I can step on your toes, but you'll still be smiling when I'm done. So And I'm going to do that by sharing with you some of the struggles I face with these things. So I'm going to tell you right up front, the sermon series that I feel the greatest conviction about are always those in which I feel like God is speaking first to me. And in this case, I feel a great deal of conviction about this. The topics are important for every single one of us in this room. And I wrestle with these things. And I'm counting on the fact that as I share these things with you, you're going to say, you know what? I wrestle with that too. I want to share my first wrestling story. I had, for the last year, been watching the internet and listening to all the stories, reading all the stories about the new iPhone. I was so excited about the iPhone coming out. I couldn't wait for it to get here. I'm a big Mac guy and an Apple guy. And my old phone had a Palm Trio, and it was several years old, and I just was clear that it was outdated and it needed to be replaced. It wasn't a want, it was a need. I needed a new iPhone. And so I had convinced myself of that, and I got on the Apple website and asked them to please send me email updates so I'd know when it was coming out, and was just really excited about this and planned on it. And then 2 months before the iPhone was to come out, I dropped my Sprint phone and it broke. Not the day before the iPhone was to come out. 2 months before. You understand the dilemma that this creates? I had insurance on the iPhone or on the Palm, and they sent me a brand new Palm phone. It's not 3 years old anymore. It's brand new. You understand the dilemma this now creates. And so I'm using this new Palm phone, and I'm just unsettled about it because I just has really messed with my plans. And so, you know, I'm trying now to convince myself in that 2 months that remains that I still need an iPhone. And I tried the best I could, but the week before it came out, I finally just in my heart had said, you know what, just wait until your phone is a couple years old and then you can go get an iPhone. And they'll be cheaper then and they'll have perfected them. And so I just sort of settled that. Now, the week that the iPhone was coming out, I took our worship team to Southern California and we spent a few days there visiting other churches and learning from them and then planning the sermons for the next year. And the first night we arrived was the night the iPhone went on sale, 6 p.m. We went to eat at a place called Fashion Island, and there was a little restaurant there, Mexican restaurant we ate at. And then when we were done, we said, hey, let's walk off our meal. And we went and we began walking around the outdoor shopping mall. And as we did, right there in the middle of the shopping mall was an Apple store. It was 6 o'clock, and there was a line wrapped all the way around it. And I said, hey, guys, I just got to go over here for just a second. I just got to see inside the store, and I got to look at the thing. And I'm standing there, you know, and there's this long line of people, and there's somebody comes out with a new iPhone. In fact, two of them. And I said, can I see your iPhone? And, you know, I mean, I just want to hold the box. You don't even have to take it out. I just want to hold the box. And I held the box in my hands, and I looked at it, and finally, the staff go, hey, Adam, can we keep walking? Come on, let's go. Okay, I'll be there in a minute. Go ahead. And I finally walked with them, and we keep walking. And we circled back around, and we came right past the Apple store again. And I went up to the guy, the clerk at the door, keeping so many people in at a time or letting so many people in. I said, how late are you guys open tonight? And he said, oh, we're going to be open until midnight if there's any phones left by that time. And anyway, we left, and we had our evening planning meetings, and it's 11:30 that night. And Dan Entwistle turns to me, he says, you want to go back there, don't you? I said, yeah, I really do. He said, come on, let's go. So we got in the car, we went back to the Apple store and walked inside. There was no lines now, and they still had a handful of them left. I walked up to the guys, there were three Apple geeks there, and they're showing me how the whole thing works, and I'm holding it in my hand now, and I'm just convinced myself I really need it. And Dan's helping me. You know, yeah, you probably really need that, Adam. And So I grab one and I have it in my hands and I'm walking to the back of the store and the whole time I'm feeling guilty. I mean, I'm thinking I got to preach this sermon here in just a couple months. I just outlined the sermon that day in the worship planning meeting. And I'm walking back there with this phone and I'm wrestling with it. I'm just feeling myself torn. Do I get it? Do I not get it? I don't really need it. Yeah, I do. No, I don't. Yeah, I do. I stand there. Now it's 12:02. And finally, the last thing that cinched it for me was, you know what? They closed at midnight. And these poor guys have been waiting on me. I have to buy it now. I mean, just for them. So I lay the Apple iPhone down. And I'm in turmoil. I'm just thinking, I hand them my credit card. And the strangest thing happened. My credit card was declined. And I have spotless credit. We pay that off every month, and it had plenty of balance left. And he says, I don't believe that God goes around turning down credit cards for us. You know, oh, it went through my credit card. Must have been God's will. It doesn't work that way. But this one time, I thought God made sure my credit card did not get approved. And so he said, do you want to try another card? Nope, I'm out of here, man. I'm leaving. And I share that with you. I, for all of you who bought iPhones, I plan to get one sometime. But I felt a sense of relief because for me, at that moment, I just had a brand new phone 2 months before. And I didn't really need it. I struggle with this. All right. I don't know if you do. I struggle. I love gadgets. I love stuff. The latest things that come out. My cars. When I have a car that's 2 years old, the windshield wipers don't start, you know, they stop working right. And to me, that's a sign. Your windshield wipers need to be replaced. You got to get a new car. You know, that's just how it works. I don't really do that, but that's how I feel inside. And I start looking at the consumer reports. I subscribe, you know, enjoy reading that stuff. I wrestle with these things. And based upon what I read in the newspaper and what I see here at the church, I'm thinking a few of you do as well. And so we're going to talk about this and what this looks like. Now, one last thing about this. When it comes to judging people, I just want us to be very careful. I can't judge you. I'm not in a position to judge you. I can only judge myself. When it comes to my possessions, I know how much money I make. I know how much money I give away. I know how much I need something and how much I don't need it. And I know when it's okay that I go ahead and splurge and I get something that I didn't really need, because it's balanced and it all works out. Or I know when it's not in balance. There was a pastor who had a missionary come and speaking at his church, and he was going to speak about ministry with the poor and justice, and they were pulling in the parking lot of the church after they'd eaten somewhere, and there was a fellow who pulls in a brand new top-of-the-line Lexus, and the missionary says, "Now that's what I'm talking about right there. I'm talking about those people who are driving cars like that." And the pastor said, "Let me just straighten you out about one thing. I know this guy. He makes $1 million a year. He gives $700,000 a year away to run the mission for the poor in our city. This guy is humble, and he's caring, and this guy could be driving a Rolls Royce, but he lives 5 steps below what his actual means are. So don't be criticizing him. Would to God that you and I gave away as much of what we have as he does." We're not in a position to judge other people. We don't know how what they have relates to what they earn and how they earned it and what they do with the rest of what they have. All we can do is say, this is where I'm out of kilter. And this is where I might need to change some things. So no judgment here for any of you, only for me. And I'm going to invite you to think about what God may be speaking to you. All right, let's talk about the American dream momentarily. What is the American dream? Well, if you go back and you look at the founders of our country, they had one kind of dream for us about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But that didn't necessarily mean what it means today. I think about other great dreams, lofty dreams of America. You know, I think about what's inscribed on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty. Or I think about the Gettysburg Address, or I think about Martin Luther King Jr. standing on the Lincoln Memorial and giving that I Have a Dream speech. Lofty dreams, but that's not generally what we mean when we talk about the American dream. That's not really the American dream. Not for most people outside of America or inside of America. The American dream for most of us is the opportunity to pursue more than what we have, to gain more than what we have, to meet success. And success is measured by the stuff that we possess. The stuff that we possess. So the American dream. When other people look at the American dream, there was a political philosopher who came to America in the 19th century, and this was his observation about America. He says, Americans are extremely eager in the pursuit of immediate material pleasures and are always disconnected with the position that they occupy and always discontented with the position that they occupy. They think about nothing but ways of changing their lot and bettering it. For people in this frame of mind, every new way of getting wealth more quickly, every machine which lessens work, every means of diminishing the cost of production, every invention which makes pleasures easier or greater seems the most magnificent accomplishment of the human mind. And then he went on to note, one usually finds that the love of money is either the chief or a secondary motive at the bottom of everything the Americans do. This gives a family likeness to all their passions and soon makes them wearisome to contemplate. Well, our American dream, of course, when I was a kid, the American dream for my family was that we would own our own home. That my mom and dad wanted to own their own home. And that home was a 1,300 square foot Cape Cod in Prairie Village, and it had a garage. We couldn't get our car in there, but it had a garage. And it was the coolest thing when our family finally owned a home. The American dream shifted from the 1960s and early 1970s of a home like that to a home that was 2,000 square feet and a two-car garage. To today, the average home is 2,400 square feet and a three-car garage. And that's not even enough. Now that our homes are twice the size that they were in the 1950s, we still don't have enough room for all of our stuff. And so one of the growth industries in America is self-storage units. And last year, that industry increased in the number of square footage offered to Americans by 24% to 1.9 billion square feet of self-storage space available for us to store all the stuff we can't fit in our third-car garage, our basement, our attic, and the rest of the rooms in our house. And this is what the American dream has looked like. Now, the American dream has been fueled by two different diseases. And two kinds of social, spiritual illnesses. The first is one you've heard of before, no doubt, called affluenza. Affluenza. And there's books been written about this and a wonderful PBS special some time ago. And according to that PBS special, affluenza is defined as the bloated, sluggish, and unfulfilled feeling that results from efforts to keep up with the Joneses. An epidemic of stress, overwork, waste, and indebtedness caused by the pursuit of the American dream. An unsustainable addiction to economic growth. I've been listening to Dave Ramsey's class on financial peace. There's a number of you taking this course, and I decided I would listen to it in preparation for the sermon series. And every time I listen, I'm finding there's things that are speaking into my life. And one of the things he said is that Americans' favorite recreational activity, 70% of all Americans say their favorite recreational activity is what? Shopping. We love to shop. And somebody said eating out, and that's probably right after that. But shopping is number one in our recreational activities. And this has become an American way of life. And you know, anymore, this has become what's necessary in order to fuel our economy. I mean, our economy now has become built upon this. In the 1950s and 1960s, people consumed, but there wasn't this terrible need to make sure that you consumed everything that you had as much as possible and even use up tomorrow's money to consume. But today, we've built our economy upon that. So we measure consumer spending. You hear about this over and over and over again on the news, consumer spending and its impact on the stock market, its impact on your retirement funds. You remember after 9/11, our president told us that one of the most important things we could do, our patriotic duty was to do what? Do you remember? Spend. Buy stuff. It's going to show how strong we are. And there's a certain logic to all of this, I mean, if you think about it. But somehow it tends to fuel this illness that's inside of us. Now, there's a whole marketing plan to fuel that illness. Every time I turn on the radio, every time I turn on the television set, there are people who spend a lot of money to figure out how to convince me that I'm not really happy with what I have and that I need just a little bit more. And they're good at it. And those voices whisper in my head and they fuel something that's already down inside me. And so I say, you know what? That's right. Those people are right. I do need that thing. I need just a little bit more. Now, the other disease that goes along with this, the illness that goes along with it that actually takes affluenza and turns it from something that's just a nuisance into something that's potentially deadly, is called credititis. Credititis. And credititis is, as you know, the opportunity for us to buy now and pay later. Now, when most of us in this room were kids, it didn't work that way, did it? When I remember growing up in the village, in Prairie Village, when it was time for school to start, actually in July, my mom would take us kids, maybe in early August, take us kids to the Jones store or to Malliard's, and we would try on our winter coats. It's like, Mom, why are we trying on winter coats? It's hot out. No, we got to do this. We'd try on our fall and winter clothing, our back-to-school clothes, and then Mom would put it on layaway. What in the heck is layaway, my kids want to know today. What an odd idea that you would save up the money and make payments, and then you got it after you paid for it. But that's how it worked, right? And usually for our family, it was like when it was finally so cold you just couldn't stand it anymore. Mom made the last payment on the coat, and we'd go get the coats out and be able to wear them. You know, big deal. Layaway. Not anymore. Credit cards. And you know you get offers for these all the time. You know that there are some things money can't buy, but for everything else there's, of course, MasterCard. And so in America today, here's what we find. In 1990, that's not that long ago. I mean, already the credit card, you know, thing was going on. 1990, the average credit card debt for Americans was about $3,000. This year, it's over $8,400 in Kansas. And nationally, it's over $9,000. Now, bear in mind, that's the average, which means it takes into account all those people who pay off their debt every month or who have no credit card debt, which means that for people who have revolving debt and it just continues, that number is significantly higher on average. The average student has credit card debt of $2,300, college student, $2,300 in credit card debt. Today, it used to be you had to make a 4% minimum payment. Many credit card companies now allow you to make a minimum 2% payment. Now, assuming that you didn't use your credit card ever again, how long would it take you to pay that credit card off making 2% payments? You're making 24% payments a year, and you're paying 18% interest a year, or 14, because your 0% financing ran out a long time ago. And so we find it takes us forever. Actually, it's about 13 years to pay off that debt. All right. Well, of course, it's not just credit cards that are a problem, though that is a primary problem. I don't know if you find this. I will buy things on my credit card that I never would have bought if I had to reach into my billfold and take out cash. It just somehow, in fact, the average sale is 100 and something like 125% higher if people use a credit card than if they're paying cash. Because we're not thinking about it. It's like when you go to the casino. I don't go to the casino, but I understand when you go to the casino, you trade in cash and you get some kind of whatever they're called. And that's because it doesn't feel real anymore. It doesn't feel real when you're using your plastic instead of your cash. Well, it's not just credit cards, though, of course. Car financing. Back a few years ago, when I bought my first car, my first new car, which was probably in, actually, I don't know when I bought my first new car, but my first used car that I actually financed was probably in the mid-1980s. And at that time, what was the standard length of a car loan? 3 years, 36 months, right? And you put a significant amount down on the car, hopefully. You didn't just go in with nothing. Last year, GMAC Financing reported 50 to 55% of all of their loans were for 72 months. 72 months. 3 years in 1970, 72 months. Now, they introduced 84-month financing several years ago. So now you can get 84-month financing on your car. And this last week, I decided I just wanted to see how far I could push this. And I went online just as a little research project to see how long would anyone loan me $30,000 for a car. And I found that there were thousands of websites who would loan me $30,000 on a car for 96 months. 8 years. At 15,000 miles a year, the car will have 120,000 miles on it by the time I finish paying it off for a $30,000 car. Now, how many of us keep our cars for 8 years? Right, maybe three of you. Okay, I see those hands. That's good. Right. Actually, just raise your hands. How many of you keep your cars for 8 years? Way to go. I'm proud of you. That's great. Okay, I'm not going to ask how many of you keep them for less than that, but obviously all of the rest of us for some period less than that. And for many of us, it's after 3 years we go to trade in our car. Or actually the average now is something like 3 or 4 years. You go to trade in that car. What's the problem, though, when you have a 6 year, 7 year debt on your car? You're what? Upside down. So the car dealer can help you with that, though, because they'll just roll in the difference into your new car loan, right? Which is how it works today. You roll that difference in, and you don't have to come up with anything down, and now you refinance it for 72 months, 84 months, and you're refinancing 105% of the purchase price. Of course, 3 years later, you want to turn it back in, and when you do that, they'll roll in the difference once more, and now you're paying 110%, financing 110%. You see how this works. You become an indentured servant of the car finance company, if this is the way we operate. And for many of us, we shop payments, and we don't really think about the long-term consequences of what we're doing. Home mortgages. Home mortgages were 30 years, 5% down when we bought our very first home in 1989. Today, you don't have to put 5% down. Today, you can do some creative financing where you'll put down, you've got an 80% loan, and then you've got a second mortgage for 20% plus the closing costs. So you can go and close with nothing down and not have to pay PMI, the nasty PMI that we used to have to pay if you do this. Now, your second mortgage has a higher interest rate than your first mortgage, and you can go in and pay, and then you can get an adjustable rate mortgage, as you know, and you're able to buy more house than what you could afford if you were buying in this other way. Now, it's even more affordable today because in a few years back, banks began to introduce the 40-year mortgage, and now most companies across America will offer a 40-year mortgage. But in 2006, mortgage companies began to introduce a 50-year mortgage. So now there's a 50-year mortgage. And when I went online, I found several companies offering 60-year mortgages to finance your house. 60-year. And now, that's not really the ultimate problem there. The real problem comes in for many of us. What is most Americans' single largest savings account? Their house, right? It's the equity building in your house. But now we have what? Home equity loans. This week I got this in the mail. This very week I got this in the mail from our home mortgage company. And somehow either their computers are off or something's not right because they want to offer us fast cash for anything we want to use it for. No new appraisal, no closing costs. No need to show bank statements or verify other assets. No paycheck stubs or proof of income required. And I can take out all of the equity in our home. And according to this, quite a bit more than what the equity is in my home. Actually, they offer us fast cash for $489,000 in extra cash. If I took out this loan, you'd have to visit me in jail. That's more than I paid for my house. But what this allows us to do is it allows us to take out all of the equity that should have been building up over time and spend it on what? On stuff. Now we're going to pay for eating out for the next 30 years on our mortgage, right? Okay, then you add to that the problem of savings. I'm almost finished with the happy news here. But the problem with savings. In 1982, the year I graduated from high school, Americans, on average, spent 89.5% of their income every month, which meant that they had 10.5% left for savings. Last year, depending on which figures you use from the government, our savings rate as Americans, we spent 1% more than we earned last year. We had a negative saving rate of minus 1%, or the most optimistic calculation was we had a savings rate of 0.5%. So we spent either 99.5% of what we earned last year or 101% of what we earned. And there was nothing left to put in savings. And some economists say, hey, it's not a big deal. That's not a problem. You know, we have our home equity's growing. No, took that out. Well, we're invested in the stock market. No, not everybody's invested in the stock market. And, you know, for a rainy day, well, there are some things money can't buy, but for everything else, there's MasterCard. All right, this is the problem that we find ourselves in. 172 families per week since the first of the year have had foreclosure proceedings starting on their homes in Kansas City. 172 families, and far, far more than that are struggling. Some of you are sitting here going, you know, Adam, that doesn't relate to me at all. I keep my car for 8 years. Everything's great in my area of finances. You know, in our home, we're not facing creditors or struggling with these things, and we don't take out the home equity loans like this. But I got to tell you, every year when it comes tax time, we make out the list of where all the, you know, all the income we had, and then I give it to the accountant, and I look at that list, and every year it's the same thing. I look and I go, where did all of this go? And I holler at LaVon, LaVon, what did you do with all our money this year? What happened with it? And, you know, she gets kind of upset. It's like, no, you did it. You did it. And it's like, I don't know where it went. Does anybody else ever have that feeling? Like, where did it go? Where did it go? And so all of us struggle at one level or another. Almost all of us struggle at one level or another with this problem. Now, the problem is deeper than what I've just described. We're going to talk in the next few weeks about how to address these issues. Next week, we're going to talk about good financial practices. And we interviewed someone at Consumer Credit Counseling. Knowing that many of you would be too embarrassed to go to Consumer Credit Counseling, we're going to take 8,000 of you there to their offices next week, and we're going to talk to one of the Consumer Credit Counselors to just say, here's the problems we see in South Johnson County, and here's good financial practices. So we're going to try to teach that next week, and then we're going to look at what the Bible says about wise and prudent use of our money. And then the following week, we're going to talk about how do we find contentment? What are some tips so that we don't feel that affluenza just grabbing our soul all the time? And then the last week, we're going to talk about a real key to this, and that's generosity. But what I'd like today to do is to just, in the time that remains, just to talk about the struggle that's inside, because there's something that's not right inside of us that has to be addressed. And if we don't address that, we're missing the most important part. All right, the struggle that's inside of us is what the Bible calls sin. We were created in the image of God, and if we lived into that image, we wouldn't be yearning for stuff all the time. We would enjoy the simple pleasures of life. We would be generous and willing to share with people who were in need. We wouldn't be focused on how do we get more all the time. You know, we would enjoy some of those things, and we might have some more from time to time. It's not that it's a sin to do that. It's just that it wouldn't be our consuming passion. But there's something inside of us that's just off kilter. And you know the list of the seven deadly sins, three of them have to do with this issue that we're talking about. Let me just remind you of those three. There is envy or covetousness. That is seeing what my neighbor has and having a deep yearning to have it, sometimes even to take it. But if not to take it, at least to go out and outspend them and get what they've got or something better. There is our affliction with greed or avarice, in which we find an intense desire for more and we're unwilling to share what we have. And then we're afflicted with gluttony. And as we keep consuming, even after we're full, we keep eating. We keep consuming even after we have enough and we finally make ourselves sick. We just can't stop. All of these are indicative of something that's going on inside. We were made to love God and to live simply and generously and to be content, but there's something inside that needs to be addressed. Now, that sin nature inside of me, I find the devil plays upon that. I don't know if you look at the devil as a literal figure or if you look at the devil as just that way of personifying that force that tempts us and moves us away from God's will, but either way, the devil works the same way. The devil is about... Well, Jesus said it this way, the thief comes to steal and to kill and to destroy. And he said, but I came that you might have life. What he wants to do is to leave you in a place where you don't have joy, where you're stressed out all the time, and where you can't do the things that God wants you to do. The devil, interestingly enough, he doesn't have to convince you to have an extramarital affair to wreck your life. Doesn't have to convince you to become a drug addict to ruin your witness. He doesn't need to have you commit a federal crime to succeed and be happy. All he needs to do is convince you to keep pursuing the American dream the way everyone else does. To put you in a place where you find yourself in debt and you're unable to give when there's someone who's hungry and you need to help. You want to help them, you just can't because you need help. The pastor preaches a sermon on tithing and you feel so crummy about that. You stay away that week because you can't give anything. You're struggling. And if God asks you to go here and to do this mission trip, not a chance. There's no way. Because you can't. And this is what the devil wants to do. Neutralize your effectiveness for the kingdom, rob you of joy, leave you stressed out. It's hard to feel the peace that passes all understanding when the creditors are calling. All right. So we think about this, and when I think about the devil's temptation, I'm reminded of Jesus being tempted. And you remember in Matthew's gospel, the last temptation of Christ in Matthew's gospel is Jesus is taken up to a high place, and he's shown all the kingdoms of the world and all the wealth. And the devil says, you can have it all, baby. You can have it all if you just leave the path that you're on. You can have it. Now, what I appreciate about this temptation story is that Jesus wasn't tempted by anything that wouldn't be a real temptation to him. I mean, that story is told us because Jesus was literally tempted to pursue wealth and power as opposed to sacrificial love. If he was tempted that way, of course we're going to count on the fact that we'll be tempted that way. Now, I remember the story that Jesus tells about the parable of the sower. And you remember in that story of the soils and the sower, he says, there's a certain farmer who scattered seed, and that's God scattering seed. That is the word of God, the gospel. And that seed, some of it fell on hard soil, and nothing happened with it. The birds came and ate it. The hearts were hard. And some of it fell on fertile soil, but it was shallow soil, and it never really took down roots. And when the sun beat down upon it, it wilted and died because there was no depth to the faith. But some of the seed fell on good soil, but was surrounded by thorns and weeds. And this is what Jesus says about that in Luke's gospel. It says, as for what fell among the thorns, these are the ones who hear the good news, but as they go on their way, they are choked by the cares and riches and pleasures of life, and their fruit does not mature. See, God has a plan for your life, and part of it is that you be fruitful, that you have a chance to do his kingdom work, and that you live into his will for your life. But our spiritual life remains immature and unfruitful so long as we're pursuing the American dream as the culture tells us to. All right. Jesus says it this way. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul? And Paul says to Timothy this. He says, some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. This last week, our staff chapel, we have a chapel every week, and the staff lead it. And at staff chapel, the message was so simple but so powerful, I thought, I've got to share this message with you. It ties so well into what we're doing. In order to address the spiritual woes that are in here that allow us to be affected by affluenza and creditis and all these other things, the real key is inviting God to change us. It is the new birth, being born again. Now, some people think being born again is something that you can point to, and on July 12th, 1972, I was born again. For me, I feel like I have to be born again every morning. I mean, I accepted Christ at a certain point, and I began my journey, and things changed, but I find I need to ask for that new heart every day. I get on my knees every morning and say, Lord, today, please help me be the person you want me to be. Take away the desires that shouldn't be there, and help me be single-minded in my focus and pursuit on you. Every morning, I need to have my heart changed and get reoriented to true north. And this is what God does. He comes and he cleans us up from the inside out. He changes us. Now, this time of year, of course, is a time for pumpkins. And if you think about pumpkins, I began thinking about what God does in our lives. And this is what our staff chapel shared with us this week. It was, when I go to get pumpkins, we go to the grocery store sometimes, or my favorite thing to do is take the kids out where you can pick them yourselves. And so you go looking for pumpkins, and you know, you try to find the perfect pumpkin, but there are no perfect pumpkins. Every pumpkin has its sort of imperfections. But then you decide that you're going to take those imperfections, you're going to use them somehow in the design of your pumpkin. And then you get the pumpkin home, and you remember the very first thing you got to do when you go to turn the pumpkin, to transform the pumpkin into a jack-o'-lantern through which light shines. What's the first thing you got to do? Yeah. You got to open it up. And you got to scoop out all that nasty stuff inside, right? Which is precisely what God has to do with us when he gets a hold of us. Is his task is to scoop out all that nasty stuff inside. You know, sometimes a spoon just doesn't work. And so you just get this nasty, smelly, slimy stuff. And this is what God does with us. As he comes, are you following me with this? He comes and he takes out all the greed and our desire to impress our neighbors and our envy and our lust for more, insatiable desire for more. He scoops it all out. That's what he does. And only when he's done that is he able then to begin to replace all that stuff with something else. And what he does is he puts his light He puts his light within us. And the goal is that when people see us, they don't see all that materialism and pride and an insatiable desire for more. Instead, what they see is they see Christ's light shining through us. That is the mission of the jack-o'-lantern. And this, my friends, is your mission. This is what God has called us to let his light so shine through us that others might see him in us and give glory to our Father who's in heaven. We all struggle with these things, but that is our mission. And so we begin by inviting God to make us new. Every morning to say, God, help me. Correct my vision. Help me not focus on all the things that are wrong, all the things that I don't have that I wish I had, but instead help me be grateful for what I do have. Help me so manage the resources that I have that when you prompt my heart to help someone who's in need, I've got the money to be able to help them. Help me not live my life in such a way that I'm constantly stressed out because I can't keep up with the bills. Help me, Lord, live simply. Help me live contently, and help me live generously. That takes me then to a theme song for this sermon series. And it was written by Elder Joseph Brackett, and I think we've got his picture. I want to show you his photograph. Elder Joseph Brackett was a part of the Shaker sect in America. He died in 1872, and this was one of the last photos, a portrait taken of him. And you may remember the Shakers, an unusual sect, but they were known for simplicity. They were known for taking pleasure in dancing and in singing and in worship and the simple things. They were known for a certain style of furniture, and that Shaker style of furniture was simple. It wasn't like Queen Anne that had elaborate flourishes. It was just simple. It was simple, and it was functional, and it lasted a long time. It was strong. It always fulfilled its mission, like this Shaker rocking chair from the 1800s. I mean, simple and beautiful, and it always fulfilled the mission for which it was made. This was Shaker. Now, today there's only 4 Shakers left in the world. Only 4. They live in community, and there's 1 house left, and there's 4 people living there. But they still have something to teach us. The most famous Shaker song, the one written by Elder Joseph Brackett, is a song called Simple Gifts. And these are the words which we'll be singing or hearing in some way every week during this sermon series. It says, "'Tis the gift to be simple. "'Tis the gift to be free. "'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. "'And when we find ourselves in the place just right, "'it will be in the valley of love and delight. "'Tis the gift to be gentle. "'Tis the gift to be fair. "'Tis the gift to wake and breathe the morning air.' And every day to walk in this path we choose, 'tis the gift of joy we shall never lose. 'Tis the gift to be loving, 'tis the best gift of all. Like a quiet rain, it blesses where it falls. And if we have the gift, we will truly believe, 'tis better to give than it is to receive. Simplicity, generosity, and joy. Would you bow with me in prayer? I'd like to invite you to put your hands on your lap. Just extend your hands, palm upright, on your lap. And I would invite you to say this prayer with me, just quietly under your breath. Change my heart, O God. Clean me out inside. Make me new. Heal my desires. Help me to hold my possessions loosely. Help me to love you. Teach me simplicity. Teach me generosity. And help me have joy. I offer my life to you. In Jesus' name, amen.